Welcome to Season 2 of Untold, the story of the Jamaican community in Canada, a podcast produced by journalism students at Mount Royal University as part of the Community Podcast Initiative. This series explores the stories of Jamaicans to learn more about their culture and heritage and their contributions to Canadian society. We'll talk to people about what it was like to leave Jamaica and how they've adjusted to life here, their successes, and the challenges that they've faced. We'll hear how they've shared their culture and knowledge with Canadians through food, the arts, business, spirituality, healthcare, and education. Many of their stories have been overlooked and untold. I'm Ethan Walsh. In today's episode, we talk to Norma Ellis, an educator and community leader whose journey from Jamaica to the cold streets of Canada is full of quiet determination and humor. In our conversation, Ellis reflects on the subtle forms of discrimination she encountered as a teacher and shares what inspired her to help found the Jamaican Canadian Association of Alberta and touches on the positive impact it has had on Calgary's community.
So Norma, why did you decide to leave Jamaica and move to Canada?
I think Canada called me. I don't think I decided to leave. I was dissatisfied with what was going on in Jamaica politically and otherwise. And I had friends here. So they said, come, it's fun. Just very cold. So I applied and was accepted, and here I am. It's a quaint thing to leave from a very warm country to come to a very cold country, but you learn to adapt like anything else.
What surprised you most when you first moved to Canada, other than the cold?
Well, I didn't see much of Toronto where I first landed, but when I landed in Calgary, one of the first things I noticed was how immaculately clean the streets were. And I started asking, how come they're able to keep the streets so clean? And I was told that if you were caught littering, you would be given a ticket. And so I decided never to litter because I didn't want a ticket. But yeah, that was my first surprise. My second surprise was that there were only a few black people around. And they were few and far between. So if you saw one on one side of the street, you would sort of dart over. Didn't matter where they were from, you just darted over. And had conversation, and you made friends very fast.
How did you navigate discrimination as a newcomer and as a teacher?
Besides the fact that things are sort of, it's different here in Canada. Discrimination tends to be sort of underhanded, in that if people don't like you, you really don't know. The messages that are sent to you are sent by not necessarily the people you deal with immediately, you know, but other ones, the ones who pass on the street and shout names. Or sometimes when you go into the shops and they sort of follow you around, as if they think you're going to lift the store and move it, or... But by and large, I think I just took things in stride. If I'm going to live here, they will have to learn about me. and I was not prepared to have a fight with anybody. Those who slammed doors, those who... made nasty comments or anything like that. Some of them, you just take it as a joke, you know. I don't think I did anything out of the ordinary to adapt. I thought, okay, I'm here, so you you better put up with me because I'm not doing anything to you, so poof on you. I also looked at it as people who did not know anything about blacks other than what they saw on television. Blacks only play football. Blacks are pimps. So, you know, I think we set out to sort of educate people, either in very small groups or large ones. We were happy to participate in some of the things, activities that would in some way educate people, because we felt that, you know, Canada was a very small place, even though it's large. A lot of the people who live in Calgary especially have never traveled beyond. Some of them still live in the houses in which they were born. They never moved. So they didn't have exposure. And so we figured our job was to simply educate and accept whatever came your way. As long as they didn't injure me, I was a happy camper.
What was the most challenging part of teaching while simultaneously receiving your master's degree?
I don't know that it was too much of a challenge, because I was doing computers, which is time consuming. I know lots of people wondered why I was doing what I was doing. People actually said, "Why are you studying computers?" I think I had more of those than as a challenge, more than the work that I was doing.
Of all the different schools you've taught in, which was your favorite?
I think my favorite might have been the first one. Reason being, it catered to students who were, I call, disadvantaged. And when you saw the change from entrance to departure, you realized that they were actually enjoying what they were doing at that school. So it was one of probably three of those kinds of schools in the city. When the kids came in, they were really rambunctious and challenging. They swore lots. And they got themselves into all sorts of scrapes. But when they did settle down, you know that, you know, the school itself was having an effect on changing them, making them better individuals. So I think of all the schools that I would consider, because I could see change, I would consider that my favorite, even though the kids were so mightily rude sometimes. But, you know, you notice change, and when you notice change, it makes you feel good. You've had some effect on these people, these youngsters. So, yes.
Must have been very rewarding. How did your church provide you with a sense of community?
Well, you know, in the first portion of my time here, I didn't go on a regular basis to church. I went to church because I knew I should be at church. But a lot of the times I was doing work, I was marking papers and these kinds of things. So, but gradually, as I got to know the people in the church, yes, it became a community. You had a few people who, with whom you could, you know, say, "I have this little tiny problem. How do you think I should go about it?" Nah, those people are few and far between. But as I age, it has become more of a community, to the point where I actually missed it during COVID. You miss going in, being with other people, hearing how they survived COVID or how they are surviving COVID and so on. So yes, it has been sort of a growth over time.
Right, and during that growth, I understand you started going on mission trips too.
Mm.
Where was your first mission trip?
My first mission trip was to, I think there might have been about 20 of us or so who went to deliver shoeboxes. And that was an eye-opener because I thought that when I left Jamaica, I had left all the poorest people behind. But a lot of these people tend to be very poor people. But they were happy people. They didn't complain as much as us here in Canada. On that side of the fence, I think you learn to appreciate differences. You learn to see people for who they are and accept them for who they are, rather than attempting to make them change, to think like you, dress like you, you know, eat like you or something like that. Just let people be. So those are some of the things. Some trips are, well, all trips are eye-opening. But that particular one also was, you know, maybe the start of just seeing the world through a different pair of eyes.
What inspired you to found the JCAA?
To found it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. When I came, I was introduced to the Caribbean Canadian Association. I enjoyed that because we could, you know, share, because although we are all from the area, we still have a few differences. So you learned a little bit more about, you know, the person from Barbados, they eat flying fish. I assume that fishes that fly should not be eaten. you know, you learn that some of the foods that you have names for are different in other places, so on. So I was introduced to this group, and we did a good job, I think, in introducing the Caribbean and its culture to Calgary. But then gradually, they split off one by one by one. Each island created its own association. The majority of us who were left were all Jamaicans, so we decided, well, we sat down one day and we said, why are we holding the banner as Caribbean Canadian Association? We are Jamaicans. So let's create our own. And so somebody says, well, that's your idea. You call the people. And so I did. I got a few people, and we called. And I think our first meeting, we had 50 people show up. And we said, you know, we said, here is what we're planning. We want to create our own association, and we need to have bylaws. We need to, if you're in favor, we need volunteers to do certain things, to get more people, and so on and so forth. And so by doing that, we thought we would now within ourselves share perhaps more of the Jamaican culture with Calgarians and maintain our own roots. So that's where it all started. I was secretary of that association, the first one, and then I became president, and I think I was public relations at one point. So I learned quite a bit from, you know, working with that association. So then, when it was time to create the Jamaican Association, I wouldn't say it was very easy, but it was easier because of my experience with the first group.
Hmm. And how has the Jamaican Association positively impacted Calgary as a whole?
I think it has caused people to think differently, I hope, about Jamaicans. I remember asking a police officer what was their view of Jamaicans in Calgary. And he says, you want the honest truth? And I said, yes, tell it like it is. And he says, well, that they are pimps. And I think he said pot smokers or something of the sort. And I said, that much, eh? That highly. And we laughed about it. But I am hoping that at this point in time, Calgarians are more aware of the Jamaican culture. We don't all smoke. Some don't smoke at all. Some don't smoke pot. There may be a few who do, but, you know, to each his own. And the few pimps that were around, they weren't all Jamaicans at all. There were those who would claim to be Jamaicans simply because Calgarians or Canadians as a whole knew the name Jamaican or Jamaica. And so there were people from other places, they would just say, we're from Jamaica. And that was accepted. Amen. Done. Nobody, you know, checked. So even when some people were deported, they were sent to Jamaica, and they weren't necessarily Jamaicans. So I hope that the presence of the association has sort of cleared up a lot of those kinds of thinking. And because, you know, we've gone to schools and done presentations. Displays at different places. I remember doing one for SAIT only a couple of years back. So we tried to share and answer questions that people would have about Jamaica. And we tried to make our answers as clear as possible. So, you know, we share some of our recipes, and if you've been to any of the Carifest pavilions, you will notice that our lines tend to be longer than the rest of, because lots of people now know Jamaican patties, Jamaican oxtail, and all of these things. And everybody tries to cook it the same way we do. So, yes, I think the Jamaican Association has, we don't only do cultural things either. We also share, we also help. And I have maintained my contact with the Jamaican Association in a variety of areas.
What advice do you have for someone who is looking to reconnect with their culture?
I mean, in Calgary?
Mm-hmm.
How long would they have left? Some people probably don't even want to reconnect with their culture. But for anyone who wants to reconnect, they can come to the Jamaican Association. We play Jamaican music. If we have a function out of a hotel, we've gone in to the hotel and assist them in cooking certain things, like jerk chicken, rice and peas, and so on. So, you know, when you're selling tickets, people will say, okay, are you serving any would the food include Jamaican foods? And we say sometimes, because, you know, it's a hotel. You don't know the chef. You don't know the experience of the chef. So, yes, I have gone in and assisted, not to cook. I hate cooking. But because I knew how to cook, I've given step-by-step instructions on how to provide or prepare, say, Jamaican rice and peas, which is part of a national dish.
Finally, looking back, is there anything you would have done differently?
Having been here, I would have left my mark when I go, wherever I go to. But mainly, I think I enjoyed the years I've been here. I've been here longer than I was in Jamaica, even though I was born there. Maybe I wouldn't study as much as I did. But even so, I think since I retired, I've made up for a lot because I've been traveling and you know, seeing more of the world. I don't think so. You think I should have regrets? No regrets. Well, I did bring my father, but he didn't like it. It was too cold, and he went home. So the only thing is I wished that I had more family. I brought my brother, and he's here. And that's the nucleus of my family here. He has three kids, and they now have kids, so I have grandnieces and nephew. But no, I don't know that I would change too much.
That's good. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time.
It was Norma Ellis, educator, leader, and a founding member of the JCAA. Thanks for listening to Untold, the story of the Jamaican community in Canada, a podcast produced by journalism students at Mount Royal University in Calgary as part of the Community Podcast Initiative. I'm Ethan Walsh. This series was produced on the lands of the Niitsitapi Blackfoot, Yethka Nakoda, Tsutsina, and Métis people. We recognize the stewards of these lands and the knowledge they bring to our understanding of authentic storytelling. Special thanks to Dr. Marva Ferguson and the Jamaican Community Association of Alberta, who have been so supportive in helping us put this series together. Be sure to subscribe to the show to hear the latest episodes and to discover new podcasts from the Community Podcast Initiative on our website, thepodcaststudio.ca.